Thank you. Welcome to Black History, Black Futures. It's our pleasure to have you all here today. I'm not going to go into too much of a discussion of the conference and what it's been for us so far. I just wanted to start with a few words of thanks. So first, I'd just like to acknowledge that we are on occupied Indigenous territory today and express my gratitude for the privilege of being able to host this conference here today. Second, I would like to ask you all to join me in thanking our organizing committee and my two fellow organizers, Adama Kaba and Vincia Herbert. And I'd also like to thank the many people who have supported us in putting this conference together. So that includes the staff at the Social Equity and Diversity Education Office, the many members of the organizing committee, our many sponsors and contributors. And I think I will leave it at that. Thank you all for coming, and I'm going to pass it along to Adama.
Bonjour. Je sais pas. J'imagine que tout le monde parlait anglais déjà, mais j'aimerais juste remercier tout le monde d'être là. C'est difficile avec le temps qui se fait dehors, mais on sait que ça va aller pendant la journée. Donc, on aimerait juste commencer par vous souhaiter la bienvenue à Histoire Noire, Espoir Noir, et aussi reconnaître le fait que aujourd'hui on est sur un territoire autochtone et c'est important de reconnaître ça. Donc aujourd'hui on a la capacité, la possibilité de faire cette conférence sur ce territoire-là. L'autre chose c'était de remercier aussi toutes les personnes qui ont contribué de près ou de loin à cette conférence, que ce soit les membres de l'équipe du Bureau d'éducation, d'équité sociale et diversité, que ce soit les bénévoles, les commandites, toutes les personnes qui ont contribué. Donc merci beaucoup et donc on vous souhaite la bienvenue et puis une belle journée. Merci.
Hello everyone. Bonjour tout le monde. Alors je crois que c'est bien que j'ai quelques petits mots à dire. Je voulais vous présenter notre première conférencière qui va nous parler aujourd'hui. Alors nous avons professeur Del Blackett et elle a une expertise en règles du travail, de loi du travail et développement international. Elle était officielle avec la National Labor Organization. Elle a aussi travaillé à l'African Development Bank en la Côte d'Ivoire. Elle a un doctorat en droit de Columbia où elle a enseigné pendant 2 ans. Elle est coordonnatrice de la recherche Je m'excuse, on n'a pas cette biographie devant nous. Professeur Black, elle est conseillère pour l'ILO sur les normes pour les travailleurs domestiques et elle est membre des commissions des droits de la personne et des droits de la jeunesse. Elle a des projets de recherche sur la réglementation et les lois, l'examen du rôle de la réforme des lois en Afrique du Nord, en Afrique de l'Ouest, et la promotion de la citoyenneté au travail pour les travailleurs domestiques. Elle a reçu le prix 2010-2011 pour l'Alaskan Fellowship en recherche sur les droits de la personne. Alors, je suis bien heureuse de vous présenter Professeur Blackett. Alors, merci beaucoup pour l'invitation de venir vous parler et je vais parler très brièvement parce que j'ai hâte de voir la prochaine conférencière. Alors, je ne peux débuter la journée sans vous parler de ma joie pour l'histoire noire qui est en cours pour nos frères et sœurs en Égypte, pour les gens de l'Afrique du Nord qui ont tous ensemble résisté et fait bien du progrès. Alors, leurs actions remarquables sont littéralement en lien avec les gens de la Tunisie. Comme vous le savez probablement, la Tunisie a aussi été connue comme Afrikia, qui veut dire Africa, Africa, Afrique. Et je crois que ces gestes sont emblématiques d'une tradition de résistance. Et c'est vraiment une tradition humaine, mais qui, en tant que gens, des gens de l'Afrique, nous partageons aussi. Et lorsqu'on parle du mois de l'histoire des Noirs, on parle de l'esclavage et des de la colonisation et nous pensons à la résistance. Alors, cette résistance est toujours en cours et le mois de l'histoire des Noirs, c'est une question de souvenir et aussi de voir, de s'attendre à voir des changements, une évolution constante. Alors, l'histoire noire est en cours, est en progression. Alors, nous allons revenir à McGill, à nos circonstances en léger ici, et j'aimerais avancer un peu du côté personnel. Lorsque j'ai dit au feu Dr. Leo Bertley, qui était professeur au Collège Vanier et à l'Université Concordia et éditeur du African Newspaper, que j'avais été admise à la faculté de droit de McGill, il était bien heureux. Mais il m'a aussi rappelé de l'histoire de McGill, y compris une lettre qu'il avait lue, qui était venue du département des admissions à McGill, à un monsieur d'origine caribéenne avant la Deuxième Guerre mondiale. Alors, c'était une lettre de rejet parce qu'il était noir. Et je n'ai jamais vu cette lettre, mais bien sûr, je connaissais l'histoire. Je savais que bien des gens juifs de la communauté avaient connu ce genre d'expérience à McGill. Alors, je suis ici aujourd'hui en tant que membre de la faculté de McGill et je suis capable de dire qu'il y a bien des choses qui ont changé. Bien des choses ont changé. Et nous devons nous souvenir de ceci. Et ça a changé grâce à la résistance et au combat de notre propre communauté et de d'autres communautés qui sont concernées par l'égalité. Alors, pendant ce mois, nous devons faire honneur à ceux qui sont venus, qui ont intégré nos écoles et qui ont fait de la place pour nous tous. Par contre, nous devons noter que nos communautés demeurent sous-représentées. Et ça en dit beaucoup que deux décennies d'institution des droits de la personne au Québec et au Canada, l'égalité sur le marché du travail, ce sont des objectifs et non, ce n'est pas établi encore. Le monde universitaire, ça peut être assez, les gens noirs, les professeurs et les étudiants peuvent se sentir assez isolés. Maintenant, nous faisons affaire avec le profilage racial, non seulement par la police, mais en général, par des gens dans les espaces publics ainsi que par des institutions d'école et des institutions de services sociaux. Alors, ça aussi, ça en dit long. En tant que membre de la Commission des droits de la personne et des droits de la jeunesse, je félicite le président de cette commission pour son courage et sa vision. Mais j'encourage les membres de notre communauté de demeurer impliqués et vigilants. Alors aujourd'hui, nous allons parler de la diversité, de l'inclusion et de l'implication de la communauté. Mais comment est-ce que ces termes sont interprétés? Et comment est-ce qu'on les met en œuvre? Et c'est ça qui va déterminer si ça va nous aider à continuer de créer des communautés noires fortes. Alors, je félicite le CID Office pour cette initiative et pour sa vision au cours des 5 dernières années dans l'organisation de cet événement et du fait qu'ils ont fait ceci de façon constante avec et pour les communautés. J'encourage nos communautés à aider CID et d'autres organismes de McGill, des endroits où nous pouvons nous rassembler et où l'égalité règne. L'histoire des Noirs nous pousse à réclamer ses droits. Alors, c'est un privilège pour moi d'avoir l'occasion de présenter un membre de la Commission des droits de la personne et des droits de la jeunesse du Québec, Mme Joanne Magloire, who works as a professional at the Commission des droits de la personne et des droits de la jeunesse in Research and Education, Cooperation and Communications. This is a department that produces, I have to say, obviously I'm a partisan, but as a member, it produces reports that are very enriching, that have a great quality, that really must be broadcast at large and read at large. Mrs. Magloire works on the question of of racial profiling, and she's going to be speaking to us of this today. But she also works on issues of inclusion, school inclusion, reasonable accommodations, racism, and homophobia. She is also co-author of the report, the consultation report on racial profiling, which will be out very shortly, in the spring, actually. So I invite you to listen to her and to ask her the real questions that really concern this this issue. Thank you. Alors, un jour, je ferai ma présentation en anglais. Je travaille là-dessus, mais pour aujourd'hui, je vais la faire en français. So I was very pleased to accept the invitation to speak to you in the name of the Commission des droits de la personne et des droits de la jeunesse to open up this day for Black History Month. I do it very in all modesty, and I'm conscious of the high expectations when it comes to our commission, but also proud of the undertakings of our organization in this field. Over the past few years, the commission was confronted to the reality of racial profiling in several ways, through several complaints of discrimination that were often placed by the Centre Action sur les relations raciales. We saw the different aspects of racial profiling, and the fact that we have to deal with these complaints brought us to a thinking process on the concept of racial profiling and on the means that we could prove it. How can we prove it? So through our investigations and in front of the courts as well. Certain results will be published despite the obstacle course, and this for several reasons. I will have an opportunity to get back to this aspect a little bit later. In terms of results, since 2006, we've completed several investigations when it comes to racial profiling by applying an analysis that was adopted by the Commission. Our efforts in mediation have allowed us to solve several files to the satisfaction of all parties involved in different contexts, with the police, transport companies, security agencies, and managers of public spaces. At present time, the Commission represents several people in front of the courts of the human rights who think that they have been victims of racial profiling, and for which the Commission has concluded to the existence of sufficient proof to this effect. We are still waiting for the first judgment on the question of racial profiling. So over the years, several groups and specialists in social sciences have looked at the questions of profiling. It doesn't matter what methodologies are used, whether they're qualitative or quantitative, or the observations on the field to the exam of official files. These studies suggest that there is an existence of systemic discrimination towards visible minorities. It's from this that the Commission decided to undertake a public consultation. The Commission has launched in September of 2009 a public consultation on racial profiling. And this consultation's goal is to define solutions so that we can combat racial profiling. And now I'm going to put my papers aside. So, in fact, we've decided during this consultation to look at the full participation of the Commission Society to demonstrate to the majority the necessity to profoundly change our attitudes. In the studies that were presented to the Commission, we saw that there was a social cost when it came to racial profiling. We also wanted to propose concrete actions and permanent actions so that we could correct these situations. It's important to mention, perhaps, that the mandate of the Commission. Okay, so in these consultations, we wanted to really raise the awareness of the consequences and social costs. We wanted to combat stereotypes and racial discrimination, and we wanted to encourage the implementation of durable solutions. So it's in this perspective that we undertook the public consultations. So
So we decided to choose a target group, so youth from 14 to 25 years from visible minority communities. Why these people? Because they are the biggest users of public spaces. And I would like to bring your attention to a few numbers. So minorities, visible minorities, constitute about 9% of the Quebec's population. However, these groups represent close to 16.5% of the metropolitan area in Montreal. And their demographic weight will increase over the years, firstly because of immigration, and secondly because of the strong proportion of the youth who are there in these groups. All visible minorities are not victims of racial profiling and discrimination within society. The most vulnerable are blacks, Arabs, and Latins, who represent respectively 2.5 for black, 1.2 for Arabs, and 1.2% for Latin Americans of the Quebec population. And for the Greater Montreal region, blacks represent 4.71%, 2.76% for Arabs, and 2.1% for Latin Americans. The members of these three groups are often underprivileged. There is a systemic discrimination in several areas, especially in their socioeconomic situations. So the people who were born in Canada, who have a high school diploma, the rate of unemployment is 14.7% for blacks, 14.5% for Latin Americans, and 19.2% for Arabs. And it's only 6.6% for non-visible minorities. Now, for those who have university degrees who were born in Canada, the unemployment rate is 6.3% for blacks, 2.9% for Latin Americans, and 5.6% for Arabs, whereas it's 3.1% for non-visible minorities. The visible minorities also have a lower annual salary to non-visible minority groups. So blacks earn about $28,000 in Quebec, Arabs $23,000, and Latin Americans $21,000. Whereas the average salary of non-visible minorities is over $32,000. And these gaps persist even when the comparison only looks at people born in Canada or having the same level of instruction or of education, pardon me. So this brings me to explain to you the steps that we went through during the consultation process. So we first had a pre-consultation. So we started from the basis that racial profiling existed. We could prove it. There were studies that showed this. It was done in other countries and elsewhere in Canada. So we started from this idea that racial profiling exists. We still met some groups and organizations. We looked at the research papers. We met with researchers to validate, to see how people lived through this, how it was experienced, and if the idea of public consultation met a population's need and from these and the needs of these minority groups. So after the consultation, we started with the first step, which was collecting testimonies in the fall and winter of 2009. So we went and got over 150 testimonies from youth and less young people, because we didn't close the doors. We kept the testimonies of the 14 to 25-year-olds, but we've also got testimonies from people in their 40s and 50s and 60s who said that they were victims of racial profiling. So the classic testimony that a person, you know, a black person who's driving a luxury car and they get stopped by the police, okay. But we also heard these types of stories from a lady who was in her 60s, professor, a university professor, who was also profiled in her car, and it wasn't a luxury car. So we heard all sorts of stories on several levels. I was talking to you about the different sectors that we looked at during this consultation. So then after collecting these testimonies, we started with a public consultation. So from the testimonies that we had, we published a consultation document where we asked a certain number of questions. The testimonies brought us to think, and we went into the different sectors and came up with a certain number of questions that we could ask to the public at large. So in the spring of 2010, we had public hearings that concentrated on the identification of solutions. So we really wanted to identify solutions. Since we were leaving from the fact that profiling existed, we said, now that there is racial profiling, what do we do about it? What are the measures that we need to undertake? What are the policies that we have to implement so that we can combat and eliminate racial profiling? Afterwards, and we are now undergoing this third step with two other colleagues. So we are now writing the report with a series of recommendations. And it's important to mention that, yes, our recommendations will target several institutions and several groups. However, we have decided, and the president has undertaken, to do an auto-criticism, self-criticism. So we're going to be looking at our own procedures as well. So why this consultation? We wanted to speak openly of the problem of racial profiling. We wanted to speak openly of racism in Quebec. We wanted to give a voice to the victims of profiling and offer a forum where we could identify solutions. And that's what our public hearings were about. So we decided to look at the three sectors, the three following sectors: public security, schools, and the youth protection system. So we took the group from 14 to 25-year-olds. That's what we were looking at, like I said to you earlier. These are the biggest users of public spaces. So we saw that youth, where do we find them? Well, we find them in public spaces, in the schools, and in the system of youth protection. And that's why we targeted these three sectors. Like I mentioned earlier, the fact that racial profiling exists, we can see that in several sectors. So when it comes to public security, profiling in this context, it manifests itself generally when there are interventions with service agents or private security agencies that target visible minorities for security reasons or prevention reasons, or crime prevention. When we heard the testimonies, it seems that the contacts between visible minorities and the police constitute the most frequent type of racial profiling. The fact that the great majority of the testimonies of victims and the representations of community groups concern police is particularly worrisome, because since this is the main entryway into the judicial system. So if racial profiling orients the work of the police when they're arresting people, well, there's often an overrepresentation of visible minorities at all subsequent steps of the judicial process, all the way up to incarceration. We had quite a few testimonies when it came to public security. I can even tell you that the majority of the testimonies that we heard concerned public security. We also spoke to you about the courts. So we've got a lot of cases right now that are in front of the courts. So this is, you know, the media talk about this quite often. This is what we hear about quite often. We will see the different types of racial profiling, and I see people in the room, and I'm certain that you've got examples that come to mind when we're talking about security, and I see some people nodding at me. But when we're talking about public security, yes, it's something that we see often. However, we were also interested in schools. There were less testimonies from the schools, but there were still some elements that were quite worrisome. In schools, profiling can manifest itself in the targeted application of codes of ethics and other actions from teachers and principals of the school. So there is a disproportionate disciplinary measures when it comes to visible minorities, especially for behavior problems, and that's a problem that we have to look at. The commission has seen that youth who are a victim of profiling in the application of school rules are often the same who find themselves in a disproportionate way in they're failing, they're dropping out, or they have less prestigious schooling. So these disciplinary measures risk to bring about, to really to really this type of discrimination that is systemic really hinders their professional future. That's why these questions could not be left aside when it came to this consultation. According to several people that we've met, the Quebec models of the classe d'accueil in different schools also have to be looked at when it comes to the impact that they might have on the schooling success of students. And there were some studies that were done recently by the ministry that talked about underrepresentation of certain visible minority students. So this really touched us, and there are quite a few people in the school settings, stakeholders, who don't really want to talk about racial profiling in the schools. And in fact, we said we'll see the definition of racial profiling later, but when we look at the definition of racial profiling as defined by the commission, we can talk about it in the schools when it comes to the disciplinary measures. However, we talk about systemic discrimination when we're talking about, for instance, different school paths, or when we talk about how children succeed in school. When it comes to the youth protection system, in the application of the rule or the law on the protection of youth, we analyze the possibility that visible minorities can be victims of racial profiling or discrimination. When there is reporting to the director of youth protection, all the way to the decisions that are taken about their cases. So then we're talking about evaluation and the cases. The commission wanted to incite participants to find solutions to the overrepresentation problems of certain visible minority groups within the system itself by concentrating on the question of prejudice and on training of stakeholders. According to the commission, these three sectors have to be analyzed. For example, when it comes to public security, all of the policies and measures concerning fighting street gangs or incivilities, that's where we're talking about systemic discrimination. When it comes to schools or their youth protection system, the examples are of policies such as schooling, continued study schooling. So we have to look, yes, there are good programs that were put in place by the government when it comes to combating dropout rates, but we have to ask ourselves, if we know that there's an overrepresentation of these youth groups, did we really concentrate on the visible minorities? Yes, we've got nice programs in place, but have we paid particular attention to these visible minority groups?
So this is why we want to evaluate it in a systematic way. So the definition of the commission's definition of racial profiling. So what is racial profiling? It designates all actions taken by one person or many in a situation of legal authority or authority in regarding one person or a group of persons for reasons of security and public safety, which are based on factors of presumed or true factors of belonging, such as race, color, ethnic origin, or religion, without a real reason or sustainable doubt, as it were, and has an effect of exposing the person to a different treatment. Racial profiling also includes all actions of people or people in authority, which applies in an disproportionate way on segments of population, in effect, of their belonging to one group or another, either true or presumed. This is the commission's definition of racial profiling. So the rights that are often taken into question, as it were, and I'll talk about the judicial case that talks about equality. So we cannot talk about this without speaking of somebody's right to freedom and expression. And so Article 7 of the Canadian Charter of Rights, each has the right to life, liberty, and security of their person, cannot be attained in this right when we respect fundamental rights of justice. And if we look at the Quebec Charter of Rights, all human beings has the right to life, as well as security, integrity, and freedom of the person. The right to the respect of privacy is also invoked often. The Quebec Charter, Article 5, all persons have the right to the respect of privacy. Article 8 of the Canadian Charter says that each person has the right against seizure, abusive searches, has been interpreted by jurisprudence as being including the protection of privacy. The notion or idea of human dignity, Judge Wilson expressed it quite well. The notion of human dignity finds its expression in almost all laws and guarantees given by the Charter. People should be given the right to choose their own religion and life philosophy, where they will go and how they will express themselves, where they will live and how they their occupation. These are all examples of the fundamental theory of the Charter. Knowing that the state will respect each person's choice as much as possible will avoid to subordinate these choices to a particular concept of a well-lived life. And so the legal aspect for the rights to liberty, Article 10, very important. All person has the right to recognize recognition and exercise in full equality of the rights of liberty of the person. So without distinction, exclusion, or preference, I'll stop there because this is basically a definition of discrimination. So there are certain points on which we can discriminate. You have them here. What will bring up our, we'll point out here, race, religion, political convictions, language, ethnic origin. Article 10 says no one should harass someone for reasons of what is noted in Article 10. So I'll just remind, so just to make a complaint to the Commission des droits de la personne, you have to be a victim, or must be a victim of one of these 13 motives of discrimination. So you must prove there has been a distinction or exclusion in regards to one of these motives of discrimination, and to prove that there has been your right to equality has been compromised. It is not necessary to demonstrate a discriminatory intention to prove discrimination, and that the discriminatory effects of the act are sufficient. There are many ways of displaying, as it were, racial profiling, and here are a few examples. A more marked watch, if you want, of people who belong to the groups in public areas. We have people who have expressed that at school because they were grouped together or talking, playing cards or whatever, were the target of disproportionate surveillance, as it were, watch from these groups. So we've heard often this type of comment. A more marked watch of people belonging to groups, road controls, as it were, of people belonging to certain groups. There's nothing wrong has been done, but the police officer decides to stop a young black person or because they're being part of a group. Application of public policies in an abusive manner or more strict in regards to certain people by the fact of their belonging or ethnic appearance. We see this in the school system. We see that sometimes wherever there is subjectivity, there is a risk to fall in the racial discrimination. Especially we see this at school where certain teachers or representatives have used disciplinary measures more in a way that's more strict for visible minorities or minorities. Other manifestations, we've often heard instances of more marked suspicion by people in authority towards people who belong to certain communities. We've seen this in shopping malls where security officers have said, yes, they have been watching more such and such a group. systematic searches of people from certain origins at the entry points, more strict application by schools of their zero tolerance in regards to children coming from certain communities, and, for example, the code of conduct, exclusion of work, and we will see that this is repercussions of racial profiling on work. The role of medias. The commission had not chosen to speak of the media, but participants during the public audiences or public hearings have spoken abundantly about media and the roles that the media can play to reinforce stereotypes and prejudice. The little representation as well, we often hear of politicians speaking of them and us, excluding groups, basically. They're often, participants said that they did not see themselves within a television series, let's say. So effectively, many people brought up the idea of the stereotype images produced by media. There are actors who said that as soon as they had certain roles, actors from different ethnic communities, they said, we always have the same roles. We have to always play the street thug, as it were, or a dealer, or something like that. There's always some stereotype that we have to play. They cannot play, do something else. There is a fragmentation in the speech, basically, as I said, them and us, and we also see it in the written media. People coming from minority groups who are presented more often as the assailants. And I'll put the last two points together. Often I see it in the written press, but I see it elsewhere as well. An individual crime committed by a white person, we consider this an individual pathology. So it's only an individual. So a crime committed by somebody from issued from a minority group, we put in a whole, we attach a cultural aspect to it. It's like, well, they're more violent, there's more this. So this came from many participants, and I thought it was very interesting to mention it. The impacts of racial profiling. We often spoke of racial profiling, but we forget too often the impact of racial profiling. So yes, there is an impact on society, on the victims and the community, but also on the different institutions. For example, the police loss of confidence that we'll see later on. And so there are social consequences, criminalization or disproportionate criminalization. I mentioned before overrepresentation. And what is interesting that someone brought up the idea, we met different groups, how in our society we can judicialize the youth coming from different groups. For example, a strict student code where we expel a student from school, this young person is on the street, so more chance of meeting a police officer, and then finding himself or herself in a judicial process. So there's also the social consequences are a false reality, as it were, that is attributed to the group, profiled group, reinforcement of stereotypes and prejudice, and I said, as I mentioned, the media does not help the situation, but also in these stereotypes or prejudices that different authorities have in different areas, inefficient tools in the fight against crime, as it were. A study in Ontario demonstrated this, that by doing racial profiling rather than criminal profiling, it does not profit anyone. And finally, it's not just those who we wish to catch that we catch, basically. And consequences for individuals, often forgotten in this legal fight, as it were. It doesn't only affect the person, but it affects the group as well. There's a sense of exclusion with this discourse of us and them. There's no belonging. Lack of trust towards the institution. We've always mentioned this lack of trust towards the police, for example. But I must admit, and I say it because my president mentioned it many times, so there's a mistrust as well for the commission itself, because at the beginning it was not obvious to go get testimonies. Why should we tell anything to the commission? Because what have you done for us? So there was a mistrust, and so we had to gain their trust. And I will mention that, I will talk about it later. So a feeling of revulsion, as it were, we can bring lead to violence and deviancy, modification of our the way of happening our habits. I have an anecdote from a woman who made me more aware of this. She said she had to change her way of acting, which means that she did not deal with her child the way she would do it spontaneously. She now tells her child, you can't dress this way because you'll be harassed by the police. You cannot, for example, a woman said, no, I'm afraid because my son bought a BMW, and now it's certain he's going to be stopped by the police. Some people said, in the evening I avoid such or such discotheque or such area because I don't want to have to justify myself to the police. So there's a change in their behavior and habits. There's a feeling of resignation and defeatism, repercussions on psychological and physical health. Family tensions and community tensions often goes with the change in behavior and habits. Solidarity or unsolidarity, let's say, in the communities. So we no longer wish to be identified. We've seen participants who do not wish to be identified to their community or with their community. Before going to the action aspects, there's the police as well that are trying to analyze the new strategies, because we hear there's always a mistrust in regards to the police, mistrust to the youth protection system, mistrust for different institutions, government institutions. So we can see the effects that racial profiling has. Solutions have been the objectives of these consultations. We heard during the public inquiries many interesting solutions that were proposed. So yes, there is a problem, but there are many solutions in different milieus. It remains that these are initiatives from left and right, as it were. And so the objective of the commission, or the commission's objective, was to take all these possible solutions and to make recommendations that also address to us, because we have recommendations for the commission as well, I wish to specify, but also towards the different institutions. Just to give you an idea, because the report is not yet complete, but to give you an idea of what we've heard as solutions, possible solutions were around sensitivity and training of all people within the legal system and the educational system and youth protection. Those people in a situation of authority who have to apply rules and laws. So yes, you will hear us talk about training, which has come up often at all levels, level of management of interveners, to sensitize people to an intercultural way of being. Sensitivity or consciousness in media. When I mentioned the media before, I think I mentioned it. Education, public education at all levels was one of the mandates of the commission, to make the majority aware of it. So because the majority in different regions, I mean, went to different regions. We didn't only stay in Montreal, we went to different regions, went to Quebec, Trois-Rivières, Sherbrooke. We also talking about racial profiling there as well. Do we talk about it in those institutions? That's a different story, but we wish to make people aware of this, because we have participants who said, we didn't think it would hear. We heard of racial profiling, but we thought that there was none here. It's being exaggerated. It's not done. But we saw that we had to make the majority aware, because when you're in the majority, it's very simple. When you watch the TV shows, you see yourself, basically, but does not reflect necessarily other realities. To ensure a diversity in employment in all spheres of society, changing policies and institutional practices, because we mentioned it a little before, yes, we can fight against discrimination, but if there is no true policy or institutional policy set up, it doesn't go very far. Other aspects or suggestions, install coercive measures to counteract discriminatory practices, because racial profiling is illegal, discrimination is illegal, so we need coercive measures as well. To measures to stimulate positive actions, as initiatives such as today, bridges between communities that say that they are victims of profiling and the rest of the population. I said in under awareness, it reaches this point. There must be a bridge between the minority groups and the greater population. Public engagement by the state and public institutions, policies and laws to fight against racism, discrimination, studies, inquiries. We need a collection of data, basically. We have to make a better study of this profiling. And so this, thank you, we will have, we're working very hard to set up and comment all these solutions. So it is to follow. You will be made aware when the report is will be published in, we're expecting it in spring 2011, so I'm open to your questions, and I think we already have a question. I have a question to the fact that you mentioned that you will train all those people in the judicial system at all levels. We will not, I'll just revise that. You will encourage training. Yes, it will be in the recommendation, effectively. So you will recommend, for example, to the police to train their police officers. Well, the solutions that were brought up by participants during public audiences or inquiries. So there's this importance, yes, to train police officers, but also management that was brought up. The city, there's different institutions, school, youth protection, not just at the police level, but effectively all people who mentioned in different sectors have mentioned that the importance of awareness and training. We also spoke of training at the initial level, the different interveners, but also continuous training. You must use the microphone, please. I want to say that the police has also started to self-study, as it were. 90% of police officers who were trained on racial profiling. This is being set up by the police forces, and they are trying, in the initial training, they're training new police officers in community sensitivity, as it were, to communities. We want to go further. Yes, there's training being done at the initial level, but we want to have continuous training, because once on the territory, as it were, reality is quite different. And so I think we have to go a little bit further than that. My name is Michael Yudi, and I've worked in a youth center for many years. And in 1990, there was a study that was qualified as being scientific that showed that there was a presence of young black youth and families in the youth centers that varied between 2 or 3 times more than the community weight. So it was more present than the with 2 or 3 times the size of the for the weight of the black Anglophone community. And this is there are different measures that have been set up and continue now, which continue with the administration, passing by the interveners in different levels. I will not name all the measures, but it follows a bit what you have described as suggestions. Creating links with the community, looking for recommendations and support from the black community, etc. And it's been 20 years already. And even if this scientific study has never been repeated, I think everyone can say from their own observations that this reality has not changed much over the years. There is also always an overrepresentation of black families and youth families or youth among or amidst this organization. Is this due to profiling, discrimination? I think we can never say no to that, definitely, as far as I'm concerned. But over these last 20 years, I've learned that, first of all, the efforts in an organization or a group to be more conscious, more aware of this, to work against these type of things, is a continuous effort. Second of all, I think we've learned that there are other factors as well that explain why families from the black communities, youth from these families, the children from these families, live or have a lot of social difficulties. And so the question I would like to ask, how, when we speak of the presence of profiling in a youth protection system, how can you speak of it and talk against it, or without creating false beliefs that if we can put an end to it, we will put an end to overrepresentation of these children and these families in this group? And I think that's the problem. There are other factors as well that compromise these families' capacities. So I do not want to see a debate that says that all we have to do to fix this is to stop racial profiling. There's something else to be done as well. Thank you for the question. This is why the commission wanted for the youth protection system to see the problem in a systemic way. Perhaps I mentioned it very quickly. I was talking about favoring. Effectively, there are many factors. We saw the question differently than just at the level of racial profiling. So effectively, there is an overrepresentation, for example, at the level of defavored groups, especially blacks. And so we have to take it into consideration. We take it into consideration. You are right to say that it's been many years that different youth centers have set up different initiatives. But what we realize is that's rather disparate. Say one area has set up programs or measures. They've created interesting partnerships with community groups, but we see that it's not the same in each, or not equivalent in each youth center. So fighting against discrimination without taking into consideration the social economic aspect is basically a sword thrust in the water. And so I agree with you, we have taken into consideration the other factors, and within the recommendations you will see we try to take this into consideration. And these are elements that were brought up during the public inquiries. To mention a bit, or to talk a bit for youth protection, what we've noticed and what the centers tell us is that they're talking about overrepresentation for signaling. There is a awareness to be done among professionals, because who are the ones that talk to the who mention this? It's usually the professionals in the health centers or at the school. So there is work to be done at this level. But what we also say for the youth centers, we say you have to be careful, because many of these centers give themselves tools to be careful of this, because we will see some centers will say, well, we'll see with our tools if there's a compromising or not. So I think they're setting up, they're building at this moment more reliable tools, more objective tools to avoid discriminatory biases at evaluation and taking into care. And so they've brought us many interesting aspects that we'll have to study, but we have to we'll have to be taking to light with other factors as well. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Thank you for your questions. Thank you very much.
Bonjour.
Good morning. My name is Véronique Lambert, responsible for the SEAT office. So in the name of the team, I would like to thank you for your presentation. Very important and very eloquent, which also gives us aspects to reflect upon and to act upon. And I'd also like to thank Adele Blackett for her presence today. this Saturday morning. We appreciate it very much. So a small gift from McGill. Thank you, everyone. And once again, I'd like to thank Mrs. Beckett and Mrs. Harpa.
Et maintenant, on va à la pause. Donc, il y aura, there's coffee and bagels, and I believe some fruit and that sort of thing out in the hallway. And I think we'll be sort of reconvening at 11 o'clock for various panels. If you haven't checked in yet, please do so at the registration desk. There you can get the full program and all that sort of thing. And if you have any questions, just look for someone with a name tag like this, and hopefully we'll be able to answer any questions that you've got. Thank you.